I thought that rather than talking about a book, I would tell you a story from the book, a traditional Buddhist story, which I think in a way explains why I thought it was useful to write a book on the mind, on finding the mind. And the dramatis personae of this story are first of all, Ananda, and I think this figure here next to the Buddha in this image may well be Ananda. So Ananda was the personal attendant of the Buddha. He was a Buddhist monk. He was the youngest cousin of the Buddha. Most sources suggest a much younger man than the Buddha, quite naive in a way, but a very lovable character who appears a lot in the early Buddhist stories. The Buddha himself appears. We also got a couple of mythical figures. Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, appears in the story. And also Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, they appear in the story. And then finally, a young woman called Matangi, and I couldn't find any pictures of Matangi, but I put up a picture of Green Tara here, because Matangi, in the course of the story, gains enlightenment. And some of the features associated with Tara are also associated with her. So you've got to imagine Ananda just following the routine of a young Buddhist monk, which means going into the town. He would walk from door to door with his bowl, hoping that someone would give him food. It's not exactly begging. You don't ask for anything. You just walk around. You stand outside the back door for a while in case the people in the house have got some leftovers. With any luck, they stick some in your bowl. And on this occasion, he was going into town, and he was very thirsty. It was a hot day. He went up to the well, and Matangi, a young woman, had been drawing water from the well. So she had a vase full of water. Now, Matangi was a chandala. In other words, she was an untouchable. She was an outcast from Hindu society. And so when Ananda asked her for a drink of water, she was completely flabbergasted. Because normally the non-outcasts would not accept a drink or a meal or touch an outcast. That's why they were known as untouchables. And of course, Buddhism was very new. She wasn't aware of the fact that the Buddha had attempted to repudiate the whole caste system. And so she said, when Ananda asked her for a drink of water, she said, "But I'm an untouchable." And he said, "I didn't ask about your caste. I just asked for a drink of water." And so she gave him a drink of water, and he talked to her and accepted the water and drank the water and went off on his way. And this had a profound effect on her. It was the first time that any non-outcast person had actually treated her as a human being. And so it had a very, very strong effect. And she kept thinking about Ananda, who was young and attractive. She thought, "Wow, this is wonderful. I've been treated as a human being by this young man. This is fantastic. I do hope I meet him again." Anyway, not long afterwards, Ananda went into the city. The city was Shravasti. He went with his bowl. He went from door to door, as usual. And he went through the red light district. And this was where Matangi lived with her mother. And when Matangi saw Ananda coming, and of course recognized him, their eyes met. And some sort of chemistry, as it were, happened between the two of them, which is described in rather traditional terms. But let's just say some sort of chemistry occurred between them. And she talked to him. Before he knew it, he found himself inside Matangi's house. Before much longer, he found himself inside Matangi's bedroom. Before much longer, he found himself sitting on the bed next to Matangi. Before much longer, he found himself, or the two of them were embracing and kissing and all that kind of thing. And at that moment, Ananda, of course, who'd taken a vow of chastity as a Buddhist monk, so this is a very serious matter. If, as a Buddhist monk, if you break your vow of chastity, you're not only expelled from being a monk, you're not allowed to rejoin. It's regarded as a downfall. So suddenly he remembered the Buddha, he remembered the Buddha. The Buddha came to mind, and he remembered the fact that he'd been so impressed by the Buddha. He'd found the Buddha so charismatic. He'd felt, here is someone I want to follow. Here is a lifestyle I want to follow. I really want to be a monk. I want to be somebody who's working full-time, for Buddhism and for the Buddha. And so this came to him, and he suddenly thought, what am I doing? You know, he sort of came back to himself. His presence of mind came back, and he simply fled. But Matangi wasn't really prepared to accept this, and so she chased after him. So he got, imagine him picking up his robes, sort of running through the streets. Matangi's coming, hey, stop, Ananda, stop, what's going on, you know? And eventually he did stop, and they talked, and he sort of explained, and she said, oh, come on, you know, what's the problem, you know? I talked to my mum. My mum says she's fine about us getting married. And I'd love that. You'd like it as well, wouldn't you? You know. And Ananda said, "Well, let's just go and talk to the Buddha, because the Buddha is my teacher. After all, let's go and talk to the Buddha." So the two of them toddled off together up to the Jetta Grove, and the Jetta Grove was the park outside the town of Shravasti where the Buddha was staying. And in fact, it's a very well-known place in Buddhist history where the Buddha taught a lot of his important sutras. And what transpired from Ananda and Matangi meeting up with the Buddha is a sutra called the Shurangama Sutra, one of the most important of the sutras in China. A late sutra, probably, you know, a lot of it legendary, but very interesting. And you'll also find the story of Matangi, although there she's called Prakriti, which is interesting because Prakriti means nature, and Ananda and the Buddha in another work called the Divyavadana as well, a slightly more extended version, which I'll mention later, of the story. So there are the two of them meeting the Buddha. And immediately Ananda says to the Buddha, I nearly lost it. I really did. I nearly lost it. Me and Matangi, we were actually on the bed. We were embracing. It wasn't far off, you know. I was really very, very tempted. But then I thought of you and I thought, hang on a minute. No, hang on a minute. I've taken a vow, haven't I? No. Now, the Buddha didn't say, naughty boy. He didn't tell him off. He also didn't tell Matangi off either. He didn't say, you shouldn't be seducing my monks or something like that. You know, this wasn't the approach the Buddha took. And what the Buddha did do is very, very interesting, at least according to the story. He said to Ananda, well, why was it you decided to become a full-time celibate Buddhist? What was it that happened? And Ananda said, well, he said, don't you remember? He said, you know, you came and visited Kapilavastu where I was living, and you were my cousin, you know, so I thought, oh, let's go and see him, and I was just really impressed. I was impressed by your presence. I was impressed by your mindfulness. What you said made such sense. I just felt you are the person I want to follow. And I just left home. I left it all behind. I decided I would devote my life to this practice. And then the Buddha said, what was it that made that decision? How did that happen? I just want to ask you how it happened. And Ananda was slightly nonplussed, and he said, well, I suppose my mind responded to you, my eyes saw you, I was impressed. My mind then processed that somehow, you know, what I'd seen and heard, and that led eventually to the decision that I'd taken. And then the Buddha said, what mind? Show it to me. Where is it? And then a dialogue starts, and it's a sort of a Socratic dialogue. If you've ever read the dialogues where Socrates will meet somebody and question them and draw truths out of them rather than saying, no, this is the case, this is the case, this is the case, to draw truths out of them. And this is what the Buddha starts to do with Ananda, trying to get Ananda to see, to find his own mind. Now, what's the connection between Ananda finding his mind and Ananda nearly breaking his vows? Well, there are a number of things that come out here, which I do want to talk about in a minute, but one of them is that Ananda had lost his presence of mind. He'd lost his awareness. He had just been carried away in a flood of emotions and all sorts of things going on. He'd lost the sense of just being there with what was happening. He'd forgotten, in a way, who he was and the decisions he'd made. And to some extent, at least, he'd lost his sense of integration, I suppose, his sense of integrity. And so the Buddha wanted to sort of help him towards a full appreciation of his own awareness, of his own experience, so that he could take full responsibility for his actions. So rather than giving Ananda a moral lesson, saying you were bad, you were immoral, you shouldn't do this, you've broken the rules, he said rather he just wanted to introduce Ananda to his own mind, to his own sense of presence, his own sense of awareness, so that he could come to fully integrated decisions about this kind of thing. After all, there's nothing to stop somebody disrobing if they wish to. Somebody can decide, I've decided I'm no longer going to be a monk because I want to start a family, I want to have a girlfriend, you know, I want to enjoy sex and all that kind of thing. They can do that, and then they can later on reordain if they want to. So you can always make this kind of decision. It's not that that's out of the question. And so this dialogue goes on. And the Buddha says, where is it? Come on, where is this mind you're talking about? And Ananda, he starts off a little bit, he's not really thought it through very much. And initially he just said, well, I suppose it's inside me, isn't it? You know, my mind's inside me. After it's somewhere in there. I don't know where exactly, but somewhere in there. And so the Buddha said, well, when you look out from this mind, can you see the inside of your skin? Or can you see your internal organs? And Ananda said, no, no, no. So how could it be inside you then? And Ananda thought, ah, I know, maybe it's outside me then, because I saw you, didn't I? Maybe my mind was sort of there with you at the time, you know. And so the Buddha then said, well, if your mind was outside you, then how could it make your body work? You know, how could you make decisions that help you to walk along and all that kind of thing if your mind was dissociated from your body? And I'm like, oh, right, you know. And then Ananda said, well, maybe it's sort of on the edge between the two, you know, and so on. And then, you know, and the Buddha, each time Ananda says something like this, the Buddha says, yeah, but if that was the case, then, you know, and Ananda, ah, right. And then maybe it's both places. Maybe it's nowhere at all. Maybe it's everywhere. You know, and Ananda keeps on coming up with this stuff. And the Buddha keeps showing him how it doesn't really hang together. And in a sense, what's going on here is that you're looking for your mind. Ananda is looking for his awareness, trying to track it down, and then discovering that awareness is not an object. It's not actually something you can find. And so, funnily enough, although I call this book Finding the Mind, you can't actually find it. I shouldn't really say that, because it's very important to look for it. It's very important when you meditate to try and have a sense of your awareness, and actually, to sort of ask questions of that awareness. And those questions can be, what shape is it? What colour is it? Where is it located? How big is it? All that kind of thing. And it's quite good to ask yourself those things and to find yourself maybe a little bit puzzled as you try to work it out. So there's this process of finding the mind. And in the dialogue, the Buddha doesn't just have question and answer format. He does other things as well. At times he's very zen in his approach. At one point, he just sort of walks up to Ananda and strokes his head like this. At another point, he'll point outside the windows of the hall where they're sitting. And he'll point out at the deer park, at the animals and the trees and the squirrels and the birds. And he'll say, look at that. What's going on now? You know, he asks him these questions. At another point, Ananda's coming up with some glib reply, and suddenly the Buddha shouts at him, and he just says, hey, Ananda, that is not your mind! And Ananda is completely distraught. But he says, look, he says, what do you mean? You know, if this isn't my mind, what's going on? I must be mad. I must be like a lump of earth or a log. You know, I'm aware something is going on. You know, and he's completely distraught by the whole thing. So the Buddha tries all these different methods. And eventually it starts to dawn on Ananda what the issue is, what the issue really is for him. And the issue, in a way, is one of responsibility. What he starts to realize is that he thought leading a spiritual or a religious life meant finding this wonderful charismatic teacher, listening to all these interesting, fascinating, useful, insightful teachings, and just going along with it all. You know, and just helping out, you know, learning it all by heart, being very devoted. But he didn't actually work on himself. He didn't actually turn his awareness inwards to himself. That's what he'd missed out on. He'd missed out on actually looking for the basic source of his own consciousness, if that's the right word. Looking at the fundamental awareness that we all have. And I suppose in a way that seems to me to be the fundamental point of Buddhism. It's not to do with the teachings in the books, in a way. It's not to do with bowing towards the Buddha and chanting. It's not to do with sutras and devotional exercises. It's not even to do with respect for the historical Buddha or being fascinated by the figures of myth. They're all there. It's not that there's anything wrong with these things, but the fundamental, that what all this is trying to sort of guide one towards, is in a sense actually being there while your life happens. Being there while it happens. And looking at your experience. And as you look at your experience, your awareness, you'll find sometimes you can just be there. Maybe it's particularly in meditation. Meditation is an opportunity to quieten down all the concerns and the disturbances that make it difficult just to be there. And when your experience is quiet enough, you may just, at least for a while, you may find you can just be there. And there's your awareness. And so that's the first stage of Buddhism, in a way, is to accept, to turn towards the reality of being aware and the mystery of it. And isn't it the most extraordinary thing in the world, it seems to me? You know, I assume that everybody else is in a similar boat to me. Here I am. I'm sort of me in some sense. And I'm in this present moment. And I'm never in any other moment but this present moment. I never seem to be anywhere else but here. It's quite extraordinary. And I've got all these sort of characteristics. I seem to be sort of associated with this particular body and a great life history behind me. But yet there it is, awareness. It's there. It's all I've got. Maybe it doesn't seem at all strange to you, but it does seem really strange to me and quite mysterious and quite wonderful as well that we are actually happening somehow, you know. And that is what Ananda hadn't really appreciated. He hadn't appreciated the wonder of that, and that he needed to take it somehow seriously, that awareness. So that's the first stage in Buddhism. And the second stage is to notice the limitations of your awareness. Is to notice that, first of all, it comes in and out. You know, sometimes you're really there, you're really with it. Other times you drift off, or big things start to come up in your mind. Big anxieties and worries start to come up in your mind. Self-concern seems to come up. You know, a sense that of neediness, a sense that you're lacking something, there's something really missing, a sense of irritation, the sense that there are things getting in your way, all that kind of thing goes on. A strong sense of self. There are three stages to that in early Buddhism where they talk about the mind-making process, the process whereby you try and identify what you want to associate with, the I-making process where you try and construct your own identity. Who am I? Who am I? And then the most subtle of all, which is called the I am I conceit, the conceit of I am. And all these are things that I go into as best I can in the book. However, if Ananda had said to the Buddha, okay, I'm going to write a book about all this. I find it really fascinating. Yes, awareness is really important and the mind is really important. You've got to find your mind, all that kind of stuff. In a way, once again, of course, he would have lost the point of it all. You know, the point of it to actually be there, not to talk about it or think about it. So I do feel a little bit guilty about writing this book and sort of producing yet another torrent of words about it, in a way maybe partly to avoid actually having to face up to this issue of awareness and the limitations to awareness in my own life, you know, which is very, very important. But maybe it will be useful. Maybe you'll find it useful to have systematic thoughts from some of the different Buddhist traditions about what the mind is and what you can do with it and how you can find it, how you can come to find it more thoroughly. And in the book I've got that particular story and one or two others around this whole area of finding the mind. And then there's some material on what's called the substrate consciousness, the alia, the storehouse consciousness, it's sometimes known. This basic sense of a ground of awareness from which everything else emerges. Sometimes it's likened to the ocean. So you have, it's as if awareness itself is a great, vast, deep ocean. And most of the stuff that we're aware of going on is just waves on that surface. And when those surface waves die down a bit, you can see really, really deeply into the ocean. The ocean becomes transparent, and all the huge squids and sperm whales and coral formations become visible deep down in the ocean. There's material also on rebirth, the stuff on looking at the Tibetan Wheel of Life as a mirror, the sense of the Wheel of Life showing you something of your own personality and the different places you can take your personality, the different things that you do with your mind. The Wheel of Life is an amazingly rich symbol in that way. There's also material on skillful and unskillful mental states, what that's all about, compassion, how that comes about, and wisdom as well. And then there's a chapter at the end which looks at Western ideas of the mind and goes into a little bit on neuroscience and tries to have a bit of a Buddhist perspective on these Western findings. And before I finish talking about the book, I just also want to mention that I was being very lucky that Vara Prabha has done these lovely woodcut illustrations. This is one of the pictures from the ox herding pictures in Zen, for example. And this is the image of the Buddha as he's sitting in his very first meditation when he was a boy. And I like a book with pictures. So anyway, I don't think I'll say any more about the book. If anyone does want to buy any tonight, I will sign one for you. But we've got plenty of them here anyway. And you may find it useful. It's intended to be accessible to non-Buddhists. It's intended to be of interest to anyone who has an interest in the mind and has a sense that maybe Buddhism has something to say about it, which would be useful. So it is intended to be quite generally accessible. But I hope you would find it interesting as well, even those who are very knowledgeable in Buddhism. So the story hasn't yet finished. And in fact, I just want to say a little bit more about the sort of the background to the story. In one of the versions of the story, the outcast nature of Matangi is really a central point. The problem that she's got in being an untouchable in India, and this is still a problem, even though untouchability is officially illegal in India, it's still a major issue for a lot, for some, possibly at least some 40 million people. You know, this is an amazing fact, but that's the case in India. And it's something which has been there for thousands of years. And it was there at the time. And, you know, I find it quite touching, that sense that she felt that Ananda was the first person outside her own caste who'd really treated her like a human being by simply asking for a drink of water and being happy to accept it and to talk to her as an equal, you know. And so she's there as well as Ananda. She's listening to all this. And the Buddha turns to her, and he says to her, well, what about you? You know, what would you like? And she's quite a single-minded woman. She says, well, I'd like to marry Ananda, please. So that's what that's the outcome that she's wanting from this. And the Buddha says, well, what you could do is to join the order. If you become ordained, effectively you will be a sister to Ananda. You will be there in the same overall movement. But he said, but I'm afraid it does involve not having a home life, you know, not being able to set up a domestic life with him and have children with him and all that kind of thing. And she sort of thinks this over and looks around her and she thinks, actually, I think I'll go for that, yes. I think I'll go for that. I like that idea. This may seem a little bit artificial. You may think, come on, you know, is she really going to go for this? But, I mean, she has been listening to some very, very profound Dharma teachings. So she agrees to be ordained. And I'll just skip ahead a little bit. Later on in the same system of teachings, in the same sutra, she becomes enlightened. So she is fast tracks. she overtakes Ananda. Ananda is not enlightened. Ananda is quite a slow learner. It takes him a long while to do it, but she does gain enlightenment within that sutra. And this is actually one of the very first stories, Buddhist stories, that was known in Europe. There was a great French scholar, possibly the first great Buddhist scholar, called, I think his name was Eugène Burnouf. And he published an introduction to Buddhism in 1844. And this includes this story. And Richard Wagner read the story. He'd already come across Buddhism because he was friends with Schopenhauer, and Schopenhauer was very interested in Buddhism. And so he read up about it. He got, basically, it was the only textbook available on Buddhism in the 1850s. So in the early 1850s, Richard Wagner read the story and decided, right, opera, perfect for an opera. That story is so good. And he wrote a sketch out for an opera, and the opera was to be called Die Sieger, which I probably pronounced that wrong, but Die Sieger means the victors. And so it was about people overcoming their difficulties in life and so on, the victors, he wanted to call it. And in this particular version, Matangi is called Prakriti, as I say, and Ananda is the other main protagonist. And he sees it as a very interesting example of Matangi, as I'll carry on calling her, and Matangi, in a way, realizing that her immediate wish to settle down and start a family with Ananda was a relatively limited aspiration. And in the presence of the Buddha, she developed a much broader aspiration, a much broader one, particularly not just to gain liberation from the limitations of, you know, one's awareness, but also to be involved in a compassionate project, to be involved in a wider project in which you're trying to bring the possibility of liberation, freedom from suffering and so on to more and more people. And this is the way that Wagner interprets her responses. And so for her, she is the victor. Her decision to become ordained and to practice Buddhism is a victory. But it's also, there's a victory for Ananda as well in there, in that he is victorious again over his immediate urges, and he remembers his long-term aims. But interestingly, Wagner also thought, and unfortunately I've not been able to look at the original text, I'm not sure how justified this is, but Wagner felt that it was also a victory for the Buddha. The Buddha himself, in looking at and getting to know Matangi and looking at her case, had made progress. He'd made some actual discoveries. He'd taken a step forward. And in fact, he'd sort of, as it were, completed his enlightenment. And according to Wagner, Matangi was the first woman that the Buddha ordained. Now, according to the traditions we're probably familiar with, it was actually Mahaprajapati Gotami who was the first woman that the Buddha ordained. But it's not all that clear, and it is possible it was Matangi. And what's more, of course, she was an untouchable. And so the Buddha did two very, very controversial things in ordaining Matangi. First of all, it was to do with admitting women into a full-time spiritual life, which had been regarded as not appropriate in traditional Indian society. And secondly, it was admitting an untouchable into a full-time spiritual life on a completely equal basis to everybody else. And this caused a terrible fuss. And particularly the Brahmins sent a deputation to the Buddha and said, you can't do this. You cannot ordain an untouchable woman. And this was an opportunity for the Buddha to give a teaching, to give him a long lecture, actually, on untouchability and on human equality and on the equal potential that everybody, men and women, untouchables and Brahmins and all the other castes have. And so this is what Wagner wanted to bring out. He wanted to bring out the drama of this. And he never wrote the opera, unfortunately. He never wrote the opera. He continued developing the ideas in the opera, and eventually it morphed into Parsifal. I don't know if anyone's familiar with Wagner, but Parsifal, some people think, is one of his greatest operas. And the female lead in Parsifal, or one of the female leads, Kundry, was based on Matangi. This is what Matangi developed into. And Kundry, in a way, is quite different in character from the Kundry in the old medieval German romance, which you know, the story of Parsifal is based on, because of this Buddhist influence. I think that's probably enough on Wagner. But just to complete the process, there is another great play based on the story by Tagore. Tagore is the Bengali poet who died in the 1940s. I think he won the Nobel Prize for Literature. He's one of the great poets of the 20th century. And he decided also that this story was worthy of a dramatic rendering. And his story is called, his play is called Chandalika. In other words, the outcast woman. The outcast woman, Chandalika. And I'm looking forward to a chance to get to see the play, or at least to read it. So, an interesting story. In a way, the moral of the story, as I say, is Ananda discovering the importance of working on himself, of tuning into his own awareness, taking responsibility for his own life, not just relying on Buddhism as a system of teachings, not just relying on the Buddha and his charisma to get him through. He thought he could do it by proxy. He realized through these teachings, through the Buddha's gentle teasing out in this sutra, that he couldn't do that. He had to work on himself. And okay, so he's realized that, but still, you know, Matangi's all right. It really went right through with her. But with him, he still didn't know quite what to do. So the Buddha said, okay, what we're going to have to do is to find you a meditation practice. This is going to be a long process for you. You're going to have to do a lot of meditation. So we're going to find you a meditation practice. So the Buddha looked around to everyone else present, and he said, I want you to suggest meditation practices for Ananda. And a lot of the bulk of the sutra is actually quite a few people, well-known Buddhist, early Buddhist figures, both mythical ones and historical ones, suggesting to Ananda what meditation he might like to do. So it's a very interesting source of all sorts of meditations. For example, meditations on earth, meditations on water, meditations on fire, meditations on space, meditations on consciousness, which is the theme we've been having here recently, the six elements, but many, many other meditations as well. And so they all pipe up one by one and suggest their meditations. And the very last person to come forward is Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion. And Avalokiteshvara suggests the meditation of turning the organ of hearing inwards. I'm just going to read to you his suggestion. Now, I'm not saying I fully understand this. It's very evocative. There's obviously something very interesting going on here of, in a way, using the sense of hearing and the sense of inner sensitivity as a way through with meditation practice. So just listen to it and see what you thought. So Avalokiteshvara says, I once met a Buddha who taught me to enter samadhi, which means a deep meditation state, through a process of hearing and reflecting. Initially, I entered the flow through hearing and forgot objective states. Since the sense objects and the sense organs were quiet, the two characteristics of movement and stillness crystallized and did not arise. After that, gradually advancing, the hearing and what was heard both disappeared. The hearing and what was heard both disappeared. Once the hearing was ended, there was nothing to rely on, and awareness and the objects of awareness both became empty. When the emptiness of awareness reached an ultimate perfection, emptiness and what was being emptied then also ceased to be. Since production and extinction were gone, still extinction was revealed. Still extinction was revealed. Suddenly, I transcended the mundane and transcendental worlds, and throughout the 10 directions of space, a perfect brightness prevailed. And I obtained 2 supreme states. First, I was united above with the fundamental, wonderfully enlightened mind of all the Buddhas of the 10 directions. And I gained a strength of compassion equal to that of the Buddhas, the thus come ones. Second, I was united below with all living beings in all the 6 realms. and I gained a kind regard for all living beings equally. Now, I do not any more contemplate sounds for my own sake, but rather I listen to the sounds of those whom I contemplate. I can enable living beings through the 10 directions who are suffering and in distress to attain liberation by contemplating their sounds. So in fact, in China, Avalokiteshvara, who there is known as Guanyin, is universally respected as the regarder of the cries of the world. This is the Chinese name for Avalokiteshvara, the regarder of the cries of the world, the listener to the cries of the world, always listening. And I think that that sense of listening to ourselves is the best way to escape the self-serving limitations of our own minds. And also listening to others, I think, is the best way of overcoming this tendency to being isolated, to feeling separate, and so on. So that seems to be a very good form of meditation, as far as I can understand it, turning the organ of hearing inwards, that inner listening process. Anyway, so all of the disciples have spoken. They've all suggested a meditation method for Ananda. And the Buddha says, okay, we need to adjudicate between these. And the Buddha says, Manjushri, you're the wise one. You can be the judge. You adjudicate. So Manjushri, also a mythical bodhisattva, the bodhisattva of wisdom, shown holding the sword of wisdom in his hand. He goes through them. He says, yes, they're all very, very good. They're excellent methods of meditation. But I think the best one for Ananda is Avalokiteshvara's method, turning the organ of hearing inwards. And he gives some more explanations as well as to how this can happen. And so that's what Ananda is sent away to do. Manjushri says, you concentrate on learning to uphold the Buddha's Dharma. Why don't you listen to your own hearing? You concentrate on learning. Why don't you listen to your own hearing? That's what he says. Because Ananda was known as a listener. You know, he was the one who memorized all the Buddha's teachings. He was fantastic at listening, but listening to that external stuff, he had to learn to turn it inwards. Anyway, so he tried and tried and tried. He did the meditation, this meditation of inner listening. Years passed. Eventually the Buddha died. Ananda was still not enlightened. He hadn't done it. And a big council was called. All the main disciples of the Buddha got together, and what they wanted to do was to go through all the sutras, all the teachings, and just make sure they'd remembered everything. Because the Buddha was now dead, they couldn't check anything up with him. They wanted to actually, in a way, establish what the Buddhist sutras were in this big council. It's known as the First Council. And they needed Ananda, because Ananda was the one who could remember the most. But they had a rule in this council. The rule said, you're not allowed to sit on the council unless you're enlightened. And Ananda wasn't enlightened. So Mahakashyapa went to see Ananda and said, look, Ananda, could you please get on with it? We're waiting. And they're sitting there having endless cups of tea, you know, and Ananda was sitting there trying to meditate. And in the end, he gave up. He said, I can't do it. It's not going to work. And he jumped into bed. And according to the tradition, while Ananda was in midair, before his head touched the pillow, but after his feet left the ground, he gained enlightenment. And next morning, he turned up. He says, all right, done it. And the rest is sutras, including this one, the Sharangama Sutra. So I think I'm going to leave it there. I hope that gives you an idea of both what the book is about and also why finding the mind is so important.